could probably fill out a connection card and get that done too. So now I'm going to introduce the wonderful April Lynn, who's going to give you better information than me. All right, get on with it.
Okay, thank you, Erica. I get to be the amazing April Lynn and the wonderful April Lynn. I like this. So good morning, everyone. Welcome to Liminal Church. If you're here for the first time, or if you're here for the millionth time, or if you're joining us online, we're glad you're here. I am one of the teachers on the teaching team, and if you are new here, you will discover that there is not just one pastor who gets up and speaks to you every week. Instead, we have about 8 or 9 people who get up and rotate speaking at you every week. So that's fun. And so I tried something new this week. I didn't write an introduction. I just wrote, say, an introduction. So that's my introduction. So launching right into it. We are in the third week on our new series on the Sermon on the Mount, which we are calling Journey to Higher Ground. And today is definitely going to be a journey. I want to start that journey in a place that's going to feel very much out of left field with the following quote. When Gregor Samsa woke up one morning from unsettling dreams, he found himself changed in his bed into a monstrous vermin. Now, does anybody know where that's from? I think I heard it, The Metamorphosis. Yes, this is the first line of the novel, The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. And here's how that paragraph continues. He was lying on his back, as hard as armor plate, and when he lifted his head a little, he saw his vaulted brown belly, sectioned by arch-shaped ribs, to whose dome the cover, about to slide off completely, could barely cling. His many legs, pitifully thin compared to the rest of him, were waving helplessly before his eyes. Now, imagine giving this novel to a friend, who then reads it and says, "I didn't understand that book at all. Something very strange happened to that man, Gregor Samsa, but I couldn't make heads or tails of it." Now, on one level, this is understandable. Kafka's novel makes heavy use of surrealism, and some people find that difficult if they're more literal-minded. But the more you talk to your friend, you realize that the problem goes deeper than that. Your friend didn't understand that The Metamorphosis was a novel. They thought they were reading a biography. Or suppose someone hands you a love letter, and after reading it, you tell them, "I'm not sure that I understand what you're suggesting here, but it doesn't seem like a very lucrative deal for either one of us, so I'm going to have to pass." The person who wrote the letter is understandably crushed, but you think that you've just saved yourself from accepting a very foolish and nonsensical business proposal. Or imagine that you were taught poetry all needed to rhyme and be written in coupled stanzas. What would you do then if someone told you that the following was also poetry? Awake at night, the sound of the water jar cracking in the cold. Turns out that there's more to understanding a piece of writing than just knowing the language it's written in, or translated into, in the case of Kafka and Basho. You need to know something about the type of writing you're looking at. All of us learn this to a certain degree as we're growing up and learning to read. It's called reading comprehension. Who here remembers having to answer reading comprehension questions on standardized tests? Yeah, lots of us. They would give you a really boring paragraph to read, and then they would ask really dumb questions like, "Why did Mary give the sweater to her brother Charlie?" And the answers were always like, "She was worried he was going to freeze to death," or "He liked her sweater better than his own," or "She was bored." But as annoying as all those tests were, reading comprehension is actually pretty important. And we use it every day without even thinking about it. If you get an angry email from a customer, you're hopefully going to recognize that their tone is very different than the text conversation you've been having with a friend about the movie you enjoyed. And hopefully you will structure your response accordingly. Likewise, most of us know that if we pick up a newspaper, we can expect a very different reading experience than if we reread our favorite novel. And in fact, we might decide to reread our favorite novel again to cheer ourselves up after reading the newspaper for a while. Now, if you're a nerd like me, you're not always happy just reading something. You want to read things that were written about the thing you read and see if other people agree with you. And this is where literary analysis comes in. So literary analysis is a fancy word for a field of study that involves intentionally examining, evaluating, and interpreting works of literature. And in this sense, literature can include any written work, not just things that we think of as literature. So emails, sermons, speeches, letters, poems, you name it. So here are some of the questions you might ask of a text that you were subjecting to literary analysis. What is its form? This is the specific type or genre of the piece of writing you're looking at. Is it nonfiction prose? Is it fiction prose? Is it poetry? Is it a play? What is its structure? This is a more detailed analysis of how the writing is ordered. For instance, if you're looking at a story, where does the conflict fit in? What order are we introduced to the characters? If it's a poem, is it a sonnet, a haiku, a limerick, a villanelle? What kind of rhyming scheme does it use? How are the stanzas arranged? Or if it's a piece of fiction, what is the point of view? Is it a first-person narrative? Is it a third-person? Is the narrator reliable? And then finally, we might ask, what is its style? This is the specific way that the author writes, their voice, you might say. So this includes the structure of their sentences, their tone, the choice of words, how much figurative language they use, metaphors, things like that. So literary analysis takes reading comprehension to the next level. You might think of it as reading comprehension on steroids. It goes beyond understanding the text in a general sense, and it seeks to understand something about the larger message that an author meant to convey, how the work's message is inspired by and connected to other works of literature, what it says about the author and the specific time and place where it was written, what the underlying themes can teach us about our world or human nature as a whole, and many more things. So what does this have to do with anything we're talking about today? I want to talk about what it means to look at the Bible as a piece of literature, and specifically how this can help us as we continue to learn about the Sermon on the Mount. First of all, I want to clarify what I don't mean when I say reading the Bible as literature. I don't mean that we should treat the Bible as just a piece of fiction. I don't mean that we should reduce the Bible to just another work of literature. Quite the opposite. Studying the Bible as literature means acknowledging that it's a unique piece of writing that has its own form, structure, and style. In fact, it has many forms, structures, and styles. The Bible consists of 66 interconnected sections that we call books, which were each written at different periods of time with different authors, structures, styles, and forms. For example, some books of the Bible are written as poems, such as the Book of Psalms. Many of the books of the New Testament are actually letters written by various disciples in the early church. Some of the books of the Bible are histories, some of them are narratives. And just as with my examples early on, we will miss a lot of the point of these texts if we don't understand what type of writing we're looking at. So to reiterate, studying the Bible as literature doesn't mean reducing it to just literature. It's about honoring the context in which the Bible was actually written and learning to apply its messages correctly within our own modern context. Now, I've said that the Bible is written in many styles and forms, but one thing that all the books of the Bible have in common is that they are a style called ancient Jewish meditation literature. I guess not called, that's just what they are. Now, this is terminology that I stole from Tim Mackey of the Bible Project. And rather than unpack what that means myself, I'm going to treat you guys to a little break in the form of a video where he will explain it himself.
So what's unique about ancient Jewish literature?
Well, a key feature is that it lacks a lot of the details that modern readers have come to expect in stories and poems.
And this makes it seem really simple.
But actually, it's very sophisticated literature. Every detail that is given matters.
And that's great, but the lack of detail means that stories are often loaded with ambiguities. I mean, take one of the first stories, Adam and Eve in the Garden. Where did this talking snake come from? And why did God allow him there? Why didn't Adam and Eve die on the spot like God said they would? And who's this offspring of the woman who will destroy the snake but is bitten by it?
Yeah, so many puzzles in this story. And some of these are questions that we have and that are not important to what the author is focusing on. But some of these ambiguities are intentional.
Intentional? Won't that lead to bad interpretations, people filling in the gaps with their own answers?
Well, that's a risk the biblical authors took in writing this way. We all tend to impose our own cultural assumptions onto the Bible, but they apparently thought the risk was worth it. These oddities are really invitations into an adventure of reading and discovery.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, the strange promise about the offspring of the woman crushing and being bitten by the snake. That word offspring is a clue to pay attention to genealogies, which, lo and behold, run all through the biblical narrative. They trace the lineage from Eve all the way to King David and his offspring. And in the New Testament, Jesus is connected to the offspring of this royal line. Now, when you read the prophets, Isaiah connected this king to the suffering servant who would die on behalf of his people. And then, in the book of Revelation, there's this symbolic vision. And can you guess? It's about a woman and her offspring. It's Jesus and his followers who conquer the dragon by giving up their lives.
Yeah, so each part of the story there is loaded with ambiguities, but altogether, it makes sense.
And this is the literary genius of the Bible. It forces you to keep reading and then interpret each part in light of the others.
This is feeling complicated. I don't know if I can do all that.
Well, you're actually not expected to notice all of this by yourself or all at once. This dense way of writing forces you to slow down and then read carefully, embarking on this interactive discovery process through the whole biblical narrative over a lifetime of reading and rereading.
Ah, okay. Meditation literature.
Cool. Thank you, Dr. Mackey. So, because the Bible is meditation literature, that means we can't simply read it once and say, okay, did that, moving on to the next thing. And as Tim Mackey said, to really read it as intended, we need to slow down and read it over and over. And looking at it through the lens of literary analysis can help us do that. Here are just some of the reasons that we should. Number one, it helps us to read rightly, such as with our example of knowing that a love letter is different than a contract. It helps give us some context by knowing what kind of writing we're looking at. It helps us to see the Bible's interconnectedness, number two. As Tim Mackey pointed out, one of the features of the Bible is that it's constantly referring to itself over and over again. So in 2007, a computer scientist named Chris Harrison started working with a pastor named Christoph Romhild to visualize all the cross-references in the Bible, all 63,000 of them, and they came up with this image. Each of those lines is one verse, I believe, and how it cross-references with other verses in the Bible. By itself, that's not super useful, but it does give us an idea of just how complicated the Bible is. In fact, psychologist Jordan Peterson has called the Bible the first hyperlinked text. If you think of a wiki and all the links and all the rabbit holes that you can go down if you start following them. So literary analysis helps us to recognize those linkages, see them in place, and understand what to do about them. Number three. This helps reveal the author's intent. For instance, if we are reading the different Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we can recognize that even though they're teaching us about the same Jesus, each of the authors are focusing on different aspects of his life and ministry to talk about different to talk to different audiences and to make different points. Not contradictory points, just different points. And speaking of contradictions, number four, this helps us clarify apparent contradictions in the Bible. When we come across things in the Bible that seem like they contradict one another, which is going to happen because, again, lots of different authors writing over thousands of years, focusing on different points, understanding things like genre and their purpose in writing can help us clarify what we're seeing. Number five, it can slow us down. Meditation literature demands attention and rereading, and we'll definitely be slowed down when we start looking at the Bible in a more analytical, thoughtful way. And finally, out of my list of many other reasons, It helps us remove our modern lenses. When we take time to learn about the context these books were written in, and we start to ask questions like, why was it written in this way? It helps us take a step back from reading it as if it was written directly to us in California in 2025. So earlier I said that literary analysis looks at the form, structure, and style of a piece of writing. We can add other things to that list, such as the cultural context and the audience. But today I mostly want to look at structure. Specifically, I want to give a brief overview of the Book of Matthew so that we can locate where the Sermon on the Mount is within it and what the surrounding context is. And then we'll look briefly at the structure of the Sermon on the Mount itself. It'll be just an overview, and don't worry, none of this is on the test. There is no test, just kidding. But I do think getting just a taste of this will help us as we move through reading the Sermon on the Mount in the weeks to come. One more disclaimer before we start. The Bible is, as we said, an incredibly complex text that was written by many different authors over thousands of years. If we look back to that visualization of cross-references, we get a glimpse again of just how complex this text is, which means that for any of these questions we might ask, there isn't going to be just one answer. And that's by design, right? Remember what the video said about meditation literature. We're meant to slow down and discover what the Bible has for us to learn over a lifetime of reading and rereading. So it turns out that also applies to the way that we outline it, as we're going to see. And we don't have the luxury of calling Matthew and asking him, hey, do you have a copy of your outline when you wrote this book? Because that would be really helpful as we read it. No, we're guessing at what his intentions were. And there is no one right answer, so you're going to see that different people choose to structure their outlines and their breakdowns in different ways. So I'm going to start from borrowing from the Bible Project again. I think a lot of us probably turn to them a lot when we want to get an overview of the book of the Bible, because they actually have really fun videos where you get to watch them drawing an outline as you watch, and at the end you have this really cool poster. I'm not going to show another video. Instead, I'm just going to show the final poster, and we are just going to look at some brief points in it. So I know that none of you can read any of this, and that's fine. That was not my intent. It's really cool the way it looks here, but I have a slightly less attractive few versions coming up that are going to just highlight a few features in it. So if we can move to the next slide. First of all, Tim, or Dr. Mackey, he has such a friendly voice that I feel like I'm just on a first-name basis with him. So I had to really resist just calling him Tim the whole way through. He points out, at the beginning of the little thing, the little diagram, he points out some features of the Book of Matthew overall. So first of all, in the dark blue box there, he tells us that the Book of Matthew is more of like a greatest hits collection of Jesus' teachings, where the teachings that the disciples memorized as they were wandering with him and then proceeded to teach in the years following his death, Matthew then compiled them and structured them in very specific ways to make very specific points about Jesus. So in the light blue box, he goes over some of those points. I went off script. So he is looking to highlight very specific themes about Jesus. He wants to highlight that Jesus is the Messiah from the line of David that's been prophesied about in the Old Testament. The Old Testament, not the Oiled Testament. Jesus is like a new and improved Moses. He draws a lot of parallels between Moses, the prophet who gets a message from God on the mountain and delivers the law, and Jesus, who has authority to deliver God's law himself. And he wants to highlight that Jesus is God with us. He's Emmanuel. And through all these themes, Matthew wants to show that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies, and he's actually the continuation of the story in the Old Testament. So, moving on. There we go. According to Tim Mackey, the Book of Matthew is organized into three major parts: an introduction, which is the red box, a conclusion in the green box below, And then those two serve as bookends for the main section, which is then broken into five subsections, those dark blue boxes. And then within each of those dark blue boxes, there is actually each of them concludes with a long block of Jesus' teaching. So the introduction in those first three chapters, Matthew gives us an introduction to Jesus, in fact. He starts by attaching Jesus to the Old Testament through genealogy, pointing out how Jesus is the son of David that's been prophesied. He moves on to the story of Jesus' birth, pointing out how that fulfills prophecy. And in the process, he starts weaving in all these details that draw parallels between Moses, as I said, the great prophet who met with God on a mountaintop to be given the law and then came down from the mountaintop to deliver God's message to the people, and Jesus, who he sees as the new authoritative teacher who came out of Egypt just like Moses did, and who very shortly we will see climb a mountain to interpret God's law. So that, if we're looking at the outline that Tim Mackey gives us, that is where we find the Sermon on the Mount, right there at the end of the first five sections in the middle. Now, if we want to focus specifically on the Sermon on the Mount as kind of the focal point of what our outline, we can look at this slightly differently. This author, Amy Jill Levine, in her book Sermon on the Mount, actually includes chapter 4 as well in the introduction. She says that chapters 1 through 4 serve as an introduction to who Jesus is, what he came to do, how he fits into the bigger narrative of the Bible. And that anticipates the Sermon on the Mount in many ways. It calls forward to themes that we'll find in the Sermon on the Mount. And then after the Sermon on the Mount, after chapter 7, the rest of Matthew's gospel, chapters 8 through 28, then show us the sermon in action. So that's a very brief overview of where it fits in. So now we'll move on to the sermon itself. Much like the book of Matthew as a whole, the Sermon on the Mount is most likely not a single sermon that Jesus gave on a mountain. Instead, it is Matthew pulling together a bunch of different teachings of Jesus and arranging them very specifically in ways that will make very specific points about what Jesus is teaching and who he is and what he came to do. This goes back to what both Tim Mackey and Amy Jill Levine say. Matthew's very intentionally writing in a way that emphasizes how Jesus is like the new Moses. And in by this case, it's having him deliver these teachings about the kingdom of heaven on a mountain. Just like Catherine pointed out a few weeks ago, mountains often show up within the Bible as places where God shows up, as places where he imparts wisdom or makes big promises. And Matthew knows that his readers know this. Now, there are people who have written at great depth entirely on the subject of the structure of the Sermon on the Mount. So I'm only going to give you the very briefest of outlines of what some of them have to say, because otherwise we'll be here all day. To start with, I'm going to show you, but not talk about, this outline of Matthew 4:23 through 9:38 in the shape of, should be one before that. There we go. In the shape of two mountains, sideways, you can see. I don't know if you can see it in the outline, but it's a very extensive outline. This is by Professor David Schrock, who teaches theology at Indianapolis Theological Seminary. My notes say Indianthesem, so I had to remember what that meant. I did think this was interesting enough to take a screenshot of, but we're not going to go into any detail on that. And then I did that little rough sketch to show you that they are indeed mountains. Moving on. Another illustration I want to take a quick look at is, yes, that one, from Jonathan Pennington, who is a professor of New Testament interpretation. He, again, diagrams it in the shape of a mountain. And this isn't just because Jesus is on a mountain. The mountain shape is actually the shape of something some of you may know called a chiasm. This is a literary device where you have parallel either wordings or themes that all line up with one another until you get to a central point. This is a little bit similar to, if any of you were here for our series on Mark it's a little bit similar to what we talked about called the Mark and Sandwich, where he takes one story and puts another story right smack in the middle of it to draw focus to and that story in light of the outside story. So a chiasm is a little bit like that. So if we look at this, in this diagram, the Lord's Prayer and Jesus' teaching on it is in the center of the Sermon on the Mount. And he's not the only one that thinks Matthew did this intentionally. Here's what David Schrock has to say about it. He says that in the tabernacle, which is the precursor to the temple, the mercy seat was the place where heaven touched earth, where the Lord of heaven put his feet on earth. But now, with the Son heralding the good news of the Father's kingdom, he is teaching how a way has been made for Christ's disciples to come and pray at the mountaintop to God their Father. Clearly, then, seeing the structure of the sermon is important because it helps us to understand the central point of the message. Okay, moving on. Another scholar who's well known for his work on the structure of the Sermon on the Mount is Dr. Dale Allison, who teaches at Princeton Theological Seminary. Allison also sees the V-like structure or mountain-like structure of a chiasm in the Sermon on the Mount. And I did my best to illustrate the simplest version of his outline coming up in one more slide. Yeah, there you go. So at the beginning and the end, there's an introduction and a conclusion. And then sandwiched in between that is the Beatitudes, 9 blessings. And parallel to that, near the end, are 5 warnings. And then in the center is a central or main discourse. So we're going to start and look at the intro and conclusion. Allison points out that Matthew uses very similar language to connect the introduction and the conclusion of the sermon, which you can see in the chart here. Like pretty much an exact identical wording in a lot of cases. At the beginning, he says great crowds followed him. And then as he's coming back down the mountain, it again says that great crowds followed him. And we can see that he talks about him going up at the beginning and then going down at the end and opening his mouth at the beginning and when Jesus finished these words. So he's drawing attention to this is intentional, like here's the beginning of the section, here's the end of the section. Then if we go in one level, the B levels in the next slide maybe? Yeah, there you go. So the first section there is the 9 blessings, the Beatitudes, and the opposite side of the chiasm is 3 warnings. And Allison points out this is meant to call to mind the blessings and curses that are connected with the law in Deuteronomy chapters 27 through 29. Now, we've already gone over the Beatitudes in some length, and Wayne is going to be talking about them in a few weeks. But as a brief reminder, these are 9 blessings that describe the sort of people that we can find in the kingdom of heaven. And these blessings are offset at the other end of the Sermon on the Mount by 3 warnings, which, funny story, I was looking at the outline Catherine gave us to say, who is going to be teaching about these? And it's me. I'm going to be teaching about them in August. So come back in a few months and you'll get to learn about the 3 warnings directly from me. But as a brief overview, these are warnings on how to avoid being misled into a false ethic instead of one that is true and good. So there's a warning on the 2 ways. There's a warning about false prophets. And then there's a warning about hearers and doers of the word. Now, what about that large section that I labeled central or main discourse? If we take a look at the diagram from earlier, which I hope I put in there, maybe? Nope, not that one, the pyramid. Yeah, there it is. I think that gives a good idea of what is filled in there. So GR means greater righteousness. So we've got a section on the greater righteousness of the kingdom and how it relates to the Torah, greater righteousness and how it relates to piety, greater righteousness and how it relates to wealth, and then the greater righteousness of the kingdom and how it relates to our outside relations. And in the first part of that section, before the Lord's Prayer, a lot of that is taken up by these 6 teachings, where he starts with, "You have heard it said," and relates to a section of the Old Testament law, and then says, but I tell you, and interprets that in light of the kingdom of God and how what he's saying is somewhat different than what they've expected. Let's see if I had anything else to say here as I went off script yet again. Nope. So as a reminder, this is all a lightning fast overview. I'm not standing here expecting anybody to remember any of this. Basically, we're going to be going into all of this in much greater depth in the weeks to come. But I hope that, first of all, I hope that the video from Tim Mackey helped lighten it up a bit and kind of give you a fun look at why understanding literary styles is important. But let's be honest, I don't think that most of us are going to be opening up our Bibles and searching for chiasms. I do think there's value in at least understanding that there is an order and a structure to the way this book was written, and that there's a reason for that, other than just giving Bible nerds a reason to make cool mountain-shaped outlines. I want to invite the band back up, and while I do that, I want to give a brief warning of my own. There's also a danger in overanalyzing the Bible, and it's that we can get so wrapped up in picking the Bible apart and sorting it into outlines and charts that we never let it infiltrate our souls. We can miss the whole point. We can get so caught up in increasing our head knowledge about the words on the page that we forget Jesus meant for his words to be carried in our hearts. There's value in seeing the puzzles on the pages of the Bible and trying to piece them together. But we can fall so in love with the game of trying to solve the puzzle that we forget these are meant to be deep mysteries to uncover slowly and thoughtfully and meditatively, and that they should impact not just our intellects, but our very lives. And now, let's see how to get off the stage.